drone attacks and missiles terrorize Ukrainian civilians.
Security camera footage captured the moment a Russian missile slammed into the side of an apartment building in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. Flames explode from the blast, followed by plumes of smoke as pedestrians flee in terror.
Plus, a large number of Russians have fled to Argentina. We'll look at one reason why.
Argentinian law grants any child born in the country automatic citizenship. The baby's parents get permanent residency status and can later apply for an Argentinian passport.
And later in the program, before the debates over tanks and jets, before the battles in Bakhmut and the shelling of Zaporizhia, we look at the origins of the war and what forces were at play. Today is Thursday, March 23rd. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Ukrainian cities were terrorized by Russian missiles and drones. This show of force came just after Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Moscow with a peace proposal. Reuters' Zachary Goldman produced this report.
Russia blasted an apartment block in Ukraine with missiles on Wednesday and swarmed cities with drone attacks overnight. In a display of force, as President Vladimir Putin bid farewell to his visiting dear friend and Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Security camera footage captured the moment a Russian missile slammed into the side of an apartment building in the Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. Flames explode from the blast, followed by plumes of smoke as pedestrians flee in terror. Reuters journalists filmed the aftermath of the shattered building. Resident Ivan Nalivaiko said, "When I got out, there was destruction, smoke, people screaming, debris. Then the firefighters and rescuers came." 81-year-old Alexandra Pavlova said she was lucky she made it to the hallway after the blast destroyed her home. Sitting in an ambulance, she said, "I have nowhere to sleep." A local official said the strike left one dead and 33 injured, including three children. And at a hospital outside Kyiv, a teacher is treated for burns from a Russian strike on a dormitory.
"When the blast wave hit and the ceiling started to crumble, we were all together at that moment. There was a lot of smoke and our clothes caught fire. I am so happy my children were smart enough to tear their clothes off quickly. We were a bit slower and we suffered some burns, but it really doesn't matter because we are alive."
The bombardment came as Xi wrapped up his visit to Moscow. Hosting Xi this week was Putin's grandest diplomatic gesture since he launched the war a year ago and became a pariah in the West. The two men referred to each other as dear friend, promised economic cooperation, condemned the West, and described relations as the best they have ever been. Xi departed, telling Putin, quote, "Now there are changes that haven't happened in 100 years. When we are together, we drive these changes." Washington criticized the timing of the trip just days after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Putin on war crimes charges. In Washington Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told a Senate committee that the world was watching this war to see whether or not Russia's aggression would win the day or go down in defeat.
"The stakes in Ukraine go well beyond Ukraine. I think if China is looking at this, and they are looking at it very carefully, they will draw lessons for how the world comes together or doesn't to stand up to this aggression."
Despite the bloodiest fighting of the war, which both Ukraine and Russia describe as a meat grinder, the front line has barely moved for 4 months.
That's Zachary Goldman from Reuters reporting for us today. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told lawmakers Wednesday that China's diplomatic and material support for Russia goes against the U.S. interest in ending the Ukraine war. His Capitol Hill testimony comes ahead of a potential phone call between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. VOA's State Department Bureau Chief Nike Ching has more.
Russian missiles bombed Ukrainian residential buildings Wednesday on the heels of Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he supports a peace proposal brokered by China. But Ukraine says diplomatic talks can occur only if Russia removes its forces from Ukrainian territory. In Washington, U.S. lawmakers and Secretary of State Antony Blinken say they are skeptical of China's motives.
I think their diplomatic support, their political support, and to some extent material support for Russia certainly goes against our interest in bringing this war to an end.
But Chinese officials insist on Beijing's commitment to promoting Ukraine peace talks. Wang Wenbin is a spokesperson for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
China has no selfish motives on the Ukrainian issue, has not stood idly by, and has not fanned the flame or taken the opportunity to profit itself. What China has done boils down to one word, that is to promote peace talks.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has expressed interest in talking to Xi, hoping the Chinese leader will more clearly see the Ukrainian perspective. Nike Chin, VOA News, Washington.
Ukrainian authorities have called for a war crimes investigation after a video surfaced on social media that appeared to show Russian soldiers killing a Ukrainian POW. But how would this alleged crime be prosecuted? Oleksiy Kovalenko tells us about it.
On March 6, a graphic video appeared in social networks that seems to portray Russian forces killing an unarmed prisoner of war wearing a Ukrainian military uniform, after he says quietly, Slava Ukraini, or glory to Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities are urging the International Criminal Court, or ICC, to investigate. Later, Andriy Kostin, Ukraine's prosecutor general, said an investigation was launched by Ukraine regarding the killing of an unarmed POW. Ukraine's armed forces say the man who appeared to be executed was sniper Oleksandr Matyevsky. U.S. experts believe the video could serve as a proof of a war crime committed by Russian forces in Ukraine.
Clearly suggestive evidence of a war crime being committed, and clearly this film will make its way into the investigations underway not only by the International Criminal Court, but also by Ukrainian courts that will look at this crime, determine which military units were in that area at that time, who commanded them.
British lawyer Wayne Jordash, head of Mobile Justice Teams, a collective of international investigators supporting Ukraine's Office of Prosecutor General, says the courts must determine whether the war crimes that are allegedly being committed can be illegally classified as a genocide. Professor Jennifer Trahan with NYU's Center for Global Affairs believes the video of the killing is yet another reminder of why an international tribunal is needed to investigate Russia's war crimes in Ukraine.
If we didn't have the aggression, we would have none of the crimes against humanity and war crimes. We wouldn't have the crimes in this horrific video, and we would have none of the killing and the harm. So it is a reminder why we need this tribunal.
Experts may disagree about how war crimes being committed should be investigated and prosecuted. Evidence like the execution video leaves little doubt that some kind of international investigation is called for. Oleksiy Kovalenko for VOA News, Washington.
A parade of heads of state have been arriving in Kyiv lately. Now it's President Zelensky's turn to do some traveling of his own as he visits with his troops at the front lines. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv gets us up to speed.
This 2 days, yesterday and today, President Zelensky is traveling, and he's traveling to the front zones. Yesterday, he was in the Bakhmut region, in Donetsk region, and today, he's in the Kherson region, in the deoccupied areas of Kherson region. At the same time, as he is currently there, we are getting information from the Ukrainian general staff, particularly from the representatives of the south area. And we are hearing that actually there are certain actions going on that Ukrainian forces are trying to get Russian forces away for 20 to 30 kilometers from the front lines, basically trying to move front line a bit further. And it looks like that the reason for this is to minimize, or at least to make it less, the shelling of the from out of the other side of the Dnieper River.
Is this push an effort to protect Zelensky while he's there, or is this just part of the normal fighting?
Well, this fighting, again, this is something that we're just getting on the same day with President Zelensky meeting, but it doesn't look that this is done for the safety of the president, particularly today during his visit, because this is something which that is a long-term operation. And again, we don't have much details, but according, again, to the spokesperson of the South area, Ukrainian forces do not want to get, you know, too much details, but there is information that actually Ukrainian forces are kind of getting to a point when they might get certain success. But again, we don't have any confirmations yet. So President Zelensky meeting is just, you know, happening at the same time with this information coming in.
Another thing we've been hearing about is now that President Xi Jinping of China has left Moscow, he's planning on scheduling a phone call with President Zelensky. Has there been any news on that front?
We don't have any additional confirmation yet, but before Chinese leaders traveled to Moscow, it was information from Ukrainian officials that this kind of call is in progress and in progress of preparation and is under negotiation. So, and Ukrainian side definitely demonstrated an interest in such call. But again, for the moment, there is no additional details on that. However, this possibility remains quite fresh, and it remains, again, according to those official statements that we get, we already got previously, this remains one of the plans by the Ukrainian officials.
We'll certainly stay tuned for more details about that. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. According to Argentina's migration data, some 11,000 Russian women have arrived in the country since the start of 2022. Many of them were pregnant and gave birth to their children there. Karina Bafrajian tells us why.
From 2020 to 2022, according to Argentinian immigration data, more than 22,000 Russian citizens entered Argentina, nearly half of them women. Many of them were in the late stages of pregnancy and gave birth to children here. Kirill Makoveev is founder of the RU Argentina agency, which was created to help Russian immigrants in Argentina. He says business is good.
Some 70,000 people consulted our website in the last year regarding giving birth in Argentina.
Argentinian law grants any child born in the country automatic citizenship. The baby's parents get permanent residency status and can later apply for an Argentinian passport. An Argentinian passport allows Russians to travel freely to 170 countries. Getting out of Russia has become more costly and in some cases impossible due to travel restrictions some countries have put in place. It also allows them to avoid being drafted to fight in Ukraine. Natalia Xenofontova moved to Argentina from the city of Ufa, Russia, while pregnant with her third child.
I have two sons. I realized that the future I had planned for them, going to study in Europe, everything being great, it all got ruined in one day. When I found out I was pregnant with my third child, we had a long think about what to do and made the decision to leave Russia.
But Argentinian authorities say that many Russian women given birth here aren't staying in Argentina. In the past year, over half of the Russians who came to Argentina, about 13,000, have since left, many of them women who gave birth in the country. In February, Florencia Carignano, the director of Argentina's immigration office, announced its decision to suspend issuing permanent residency for Russian citizens who give birth in Argentina but spend most of their time in other countries.
In January 2023, 4,523 Russian citizens entered Argentina. And these numbers are growing dramatically. We can see the growing number of incoming flights, the growing number of pregnant Russian women.
Alla and Andrei Prigolovkin stayed. They initially came to Argentina to avoid the possibility her husband might be drafted to fight in Ukraine.
I told him that I worry that he can get into mobilization, and I'm afraid that he can die on this war and I will grow our baby alone.
Natalia Xenofontova also has no plans to leave Argentina. For now, she and her husband are working remotely, learning Spanish and looking for jobs in Buenos Aires. They say this is their new home and along with it, new hope for a bright future for their children. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
We've been talking about the one-year anniversary of the war, about the debate over jets and tanks. We've been looking at the fighting in Bakhmut, and we've been discussing the electric grid and the power plants. But how did we get here? I'm joined by Stephen Sestanovich, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, for a look at the origins of the conflict. Now, many people would say the conflict began when Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, but just what led them to do that?
I think one has to be clear about the use of they here. The decision to actually launch a big war against Ukraine was not a decision made by any sort of them. It was made by Putin. And Putin has, over time, developed a kind of increasing hostility toward the idea of an independent Ukrainian state, which has taken many different turns over 20 years. It's become more acute in the past couple of years. He's published rather odd articles about Ukraine for a millennium representing a kind of treason against Russia, that it's the, you know, a lever that foreign powers use to weaken Russia, to try to destroy it. So he conjured in his mind a very civilizational conflict, one involving Russia's isolation in the world, encirclement. Honestly, one would have to describe some of this as a paranoid fantasy. But of course, it also had the context of overall worsening relations with the West. And in Putin's mind, this took on a kind of historical significance for his own place in Russian history. I think ultimately, if you ask Russians what was the cause of this war, they will say Putin's desire to be remembered like the czars.
Interesting. So it almost sounds like what you're saying is that it's really Vladimir Putin who wanted this, and they're creating the kind of propaganda messaging to justify that rather than the other way around.
To be sure. But one should also, to get a real grasp of what this issue is all about, one has to understand what Ukraine is all about. Why does it have this kind of significance for him? Ukraine has been a divided country, like any large country of 45 million people. It has its regional differences. That regionalism has played a role in its politics from the time of, from the beginning of its independent existence and when the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, the first president of Ukraine was from the West. The second president was from the East. The third president was from the West. The fourth president was from the East. And some of these regional differences had a kind of sharper edge than just, you know, well, I'm from the East or I'm from the West. There were, you know, sort of authentic cultural, linguistic, religious historical differences. But one shouldn't exaggerate those. These were not really differences that amounted to separatism or to some kind of, ineradicable conflict. In the East, which was linguistically more Russian, more Orthodox, there was a preference not to have Russia be an enemy, not to be part of Russia. In the West, there was a stronger desire to be part of Europe, not to be dominated by Russia, but also not to be at war with Russia. And mostly Ukrainian politicians managed these tensions pretty responsibly. And you had crises in the 30 years of Ukrainian independence and the 20 years under Putin, when there seemed to be the possibility of a dramatic shift in the rules of the game in Ukrainian politics. In 2004, what was called the Orange Revolution was triggered by electoral falsification that made it seem as though one side was going to be dominant, in a position to dominate permanently. In 2014, what was called the Revolution of Dignity was triggered by brutal treatment, among other things, by brutal treatment of protesters.
And what were those protesters protesting against?
Well, they were, some of what brought them into the streets was this same difference that I've been describing between East and West. Putin had launched a campaign to bring Ukraine into what was called the Eurasian Economic Union, to keep it from a close relationship with the EU. The president at the time, Yanukovych, was in a position where he had promised actually closer relations with the EU, then switched in Putin's direction. And this produced protests, but the protests would not have culminated in a revolution, except for the fact that there was a very repressive, over many months, repeated brutal crackdowns on the crowds that were gathered in Kiev to demand this closer relationship with the EU. And Putin's response to this, because what ended up happening was his guy Yanukovych was brought down by the anger that was triggered after this treatment, particular killings of many people. And his response was, okay, I'm not going to take this lying down. I'm going to have to retaliate. And from that, you got the seizure of Crimea. You got the stoking of a separate war in the East, in eastern Ukraine. And, from that conflict, you can draw a line to the real full-scale war of today.
That's Stephen Sestanovich, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.